I'm Matthew Petty, and this is Intersection. Florida's population is growing. Last year, Florida overtook New York to become the third most populous state in the nation. But the human population isn't the only one on the uptick. The black bear population is growing too. And as urban areas encroach on bear habitat, the chance of seeing a bear goes up, and those encounters don't always go so well for bears or people. In recent years, some people have been mauled by bears that have lost their fear of humans. So for the first time in 20 years, Florida wildlife officials are issuing permits to hunt the bears. That's in the face of opposition from environmentalists and even some hunters. Coming up, we'll talk to an opponent of the bear hunt and a veteran bear hunter. There's been an outpouring of protest from environmentalists, and a lawsuit was filed last Friday which alleges the hunt is unconstitutional. But officials with the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission say there's good scientific research to back the state's seven-day bear hunt. Diane Eggerman from the FWC will help oversee the hunt. Here she is talking to reporters on a conference call Monday.
The commission validly adopted rules allowing for a limited bear hunt based on sound reasoning and with careful consideration of the issues involved. And we're confident that the actions will prevail.
Permits went on sale on Monday morning and will be available up until midnight on October 23rd. There's an estimated 3,000 bears in the state, and the FWC will allow 320 of them to be killed in the hunt. Well, joining me now to talk about the hunt is Brad McNaughton. He's the president of the Central Florida Bear Hunters Association. Brad, thanks for calling in.
You're welcome.
And in the studio is Chuck O'Neill. He's the first vice president of the League of Women Voters of Florida. Chuck, thanks for joining us.
It's great to be here, Matt.
Well, let's start first by hearing from Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission Vice Chairman Brian Yablonsky talking about black bear populations in Florida.
There are more bears in Florida today than in any time since 1914. And in 1914, we only had about 1 million people, and today, as it was noted, we're approaching 20 million people.
Brad McNaughton, let me ask you this for starters. How is the hunt going to work?
It's going to be kind of sketchy to start with. I mean, I don't really consider it dangerous. There's going to be a lot of inexperienced bear hunters out there that might take some uncautious steps and what they're doing, but that's how the Game Commission wants it done.
It's a fairly short window, too, just a week, I think.
Yes, sir. From what I can, from what they've told me and at the meetings and different things, they were going to guarantee 2 days of hunting, and then they'd have to check in every afternoon to see if how the quota was being filled.
So, what makes you think there's going to be a lot of inexperienced bear hunters?
Well, there's just not a lot of bear hunters in Florida that still hunt. Back in 94 when it was shut down, 98% of the bear hunters that were in Florida were, dog hunters that did it with dogs. And when they closed it down, a good portion of them quit and retired, and then the other portion just migrated to South Georgia to continue their heritage.
And some hunters have also expressed some concerns with how the Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission will regulate the hunt. Do you share some of those concerns?
The only concerns that we have is, it's bear hunting. The average bear hunter is not a – they don't want to kill 50 bear in their lifetime. I mean, they want to take a trophy. And, when they do it with dogs, a bear hunter that does it with dogs, they're more about the heritage of their ancestors that have raised these dogs for generations and generations, and we want the population to be three times what it is, but the habitat's not there for it. We'd love the bear population to be, 500,000, but every time somebody retires, they want to move to Florida, and it's not the bear's fault, it's not the hunter's fault, it's not the people that like to watch them's fault. We raise cattle, and the more cattle you have, the more money you make. But You can't have but so many head of cattle on 500 acres of land. That's the same thing with the bears. No matter what happens, there's only so much habitat to hold them.
Right. So essentially kind of running out of wild space for those black bears.
Exactly.
Chuck O'Neill, I want to bring you on the conversation. How do you feel about using a hunt as a way to manage the black bear population?
Well, one of the problems that we brought up at the first commission meeting was that there was a lack of a natural food source for the black bear. Back in 2007, black bears, mostly females with their cubs, invaded the neighboring subdivisions of the Ocala National Forest. And it was found that the reason why they did that was that there was harvesting of the saw palmetto berries going on in that Ocala National Forest beyond the boundaries.
When you say harvesting, what do you mean by that?
Well, that there are pickers that go into the saw palmetto patches and they harvest, they cut out the saw palmetto berries, what they refer to as droops. And these are a very important part of the black bear's natural food supply. So it's been scientifically proven that there's an inverse proportionality between the availability of natural food for a black bear and the incidence of bear-human conflicts.
Mm-hmm.
So we brought this up at the first meeting, and then by the time we had the last meeting, we found that actually the State Forest Service had been selling permits to harvest saw palmetto berries in the 1.1 million acres of state forest. So when you have one agency depleting a food source for the black bear and then another agency trying to stop bear-human conflicts, the two agencies were not coordinating them. And by the time of the last meeting, Adam Putnam agreed to suspend the harvesting of saw palmetto berries in state forest. So we feel that they should give this time to see if restoring the natural food supply has an effect on the bear-human conflicts. And I don't think that there's any question that this hunt is due to the bear-human conflicts. I know they say it's to manage population, but it's all coming about coinciding with recent bear-human conflicts.
As you both know, Chuck O'Neill and Brad McNaughton, there's a lot of emotion around this idea of bear hunting. At a public hearing for the bear hunt, one of the FWC meetings there was, this is what one opponent of the hunt had to say about bears encroaching on their property.
But if I was to get mauled by a bear, I tell you, you know, I welcome it. I'd say, yeah, I'm in your territory. And I mean, that's really how I feel.
Chuck O'Neill, that's kind of a one end of the spectrum there. Who's right here? Humans encroaching on the bear's natural habitat or bears coming into our developed areas?
I think they're coming into areas that used to be their habitat. And, you know, this is one of the problems up on the east side of the Wakaba State Park in the Markham Woods area is that a lot of that woodlands there has been developed into high-priced real estate so that yes, you're going to get bears encountering people in that area. And, you know, if you have somebody walking a dog, dogs and bears are historic enemies. So it's kind of natural that a bear would react adversely to a barking dog, especially if the barking dog is around the cubs.
Just getting back to this first hunt coming up, Brad McNaughton, this is the first hunt in 20-some years. What are members of your club saying?
We're mostly pro-dog hunting, and there's a few people that are going to buy permits, but as a rule, the majority of us aren't going to buy a permit.
How about yourself? Are you looking to buy a permit, Brad?
No, sir. To us, when it all comes down to it, people think, you know, the bear hunters are, they want to go out and kill, but if we're as far from the fact, the size limit's 100 pounds. Anything over 100 pounds, male or female, you can harvest. In Georgia, where we hunt, it's 75 pounds. We ourselves have a minimum weight of 250 pounds. We don't kill anything under 250 pounds.
So you're going after the big guys.
Well, if somebody wants to kill a bear, why don't they kill a trophy? We pay $300 a year, over $300 a year just for a license to go to Georgia to hunt. I think $100 for a resident, $300 for an out-of-state, you know, I think that's absurd in my book. I mean, I think it needs to be up 500 and 1,000 at least. That way you get the serious people that are going to take the good shots, that are going to be serious about it, and and not just somebody, oh, well, here's $100, let me go out there and shoot something, you know, rather than be serious about it. You wouldn't really have to have the call in for the quota. Everybody would do it. You wouldn't have half the people out there wanting to kill the bear.
So you think the price of the permit should go up. Chuck O'Neill, what do you think about that idea?
I think, you know, the price of the permit certainly would limit the number of people who are out there. I actually share Brad's concern that they are selling permits to too many people. If they're going after 300 bears, why do you need to sell, you know, 5,000 permits? I, as someone who lives around the border of Wakiva State Park, I'm also concerned that some of these hunters who have never hunted bears or may have never hunted before are going to be wandering around neighborhoods with their guns, not experts at hunting, and those stray shots may go into our houses. So, you know, it's a matter of safety for those of us who live around the state park as well.
Brad McNaughton, you're talking about trophy hunting primarily, especially for folks in your club, folks who go up to Georgia to hunt. But what about using the meat? Do people do that?
Yes, sir. One hunt. There's usually 15 to 18 of us that hunt. We hunt together up there. We've subleased about 50,000 acres up there. And out of the 15 to 18 people, we harvest maybe 3 to 4 bear a year. And 100% of that bear, all the meat gets processed. We have it made into sausage and different things, and we split it up. Whoever killed the bear, they take that and have it mounted. The last 6 years, every bear that's been killed has been a first-time harvest, and they have went and had it mounted, and it's and on the wall. You know, it's nothing. It's not like a we're just killing them and throwing them. The meat is very edible. It's not something you want to eat every day, but we like it.
Brad McNaughton, what are you anticipating is going to happen in this hunt? Do you think it's going to be a success?
The first year, no, I don't. What the gentleman said earlier is the bear are going back to where they were. I want to believe that, but in my heart, I've hunted in places for 40-plus years deer hunting in Florida and never see a bear track. My grandfather hunted that land for 40 years before I did, and they had beehives on there, and one bear in 40 years that he farmed that land and run cattle. The reason I think the hunt is in the first year or two, it's not going to really have any effect is because the bear that have been pushed into the subdivision and the young bear that are being pushed into there now are bears that are being pushed out of Wakiva, pushed out of Ocala, out of Osceola. The juvenile bears are getting pushed out. Yes, there is big bears in those areas like Sanford, Lake Mary, but those bears were pushed out 6 years ago, 8 years ago.
So you're saying you're unlikely to see those bears if you're out hunting in the wild anyway?
The problem is still going to be in the neighborhood because you can't hunt them in the neighborhood. What you're doing is you're taking bears out of the herd this year, next year, the next year, and you will see the influx of bears getting pushed out of those homeland habitat areas. You'll see the number of bears going into the neighborhoods will dwindle down. But then that's a whole nother step is because the bears that are in the neighborhoods, they're breeding and having cubs in those neighborhoods. Without a doubt, it is 110% got to do with habitat. If there was enough vacant timberland in the state of Florida, the bears would not be there, period. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm not scared of any bear in the state of Florida in the woods. Because they're going to run. You get in the neighborhoods where they're used to running people off, running animals off, they've lost the fear of man. That's a whole, to me, a whole other species of bear because it's just not the same as a wild bear.
Just to clarify, too, what are your reasons for not wanting to take part in this particular hunt?
I don't justify taking small animals. The thing of it is you could take 1,000 bear a year. If everybody harvested male boar bears only, still hunting, there is no way, unless you watch that boar walk up to that female and watch him breed her, That's the only way killing one from a tree stand or a blind, you can tell what sex it is. You're anywhere from 50 to 300 yards from them. When you're with a dog and you have it in a tree, you're within 20 to 30 yards of it to make a good, clean shot. There's going to be half or more of the bears killed are going to be female bears, and I don't justify any of that.
Chuck O'Neill, final thoughts from you. What impact do you think this hunt is going to have on the bear population?
As Brad said, one of the rules is that they cannot shoot bears under 100 pounds, and they cannot shoot females if they are in the presence of cubs. So they're saying basically you can shoot females over 100 pounds. The whole part about in the presence of cubs, who's going to be there to monitor whether the cubs were present when that female was shot? I mean, we have an expert bear hunter on the phone. He is not getting a permit. He does not feel that this, the way they've set up this hunt, is ethical. I don't know if there's any more of a testament that someone like myself could say that this is not being done correctly. FWC has not gone through the steps necessary to make this a good hunt. And to sell permits to anyone who has $100 and a rifle is a recipe for disaster. And I hope I'm wrong, but the way this has gone so far, this is turning into a real nightmare.
Well, I guess we'll see what happens when the hunt arrives. Chuck O'Neill is the first vice president of the League of Women Voters in Florida. Chuck, thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you, Matt.
And we are joined on the phone by Brad McNaughton. He's the president of the Central Florida Bear Hunters Association. Brad, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Anytime, sir.
The urban areas that are encroaching into the woods and bringing people in contact with bears also have an impact on Florida's wetlands. Coming up after the break, Tampa Bay Times environmental reporter Craig Pittman joins me to talk about the challenge of preserving wetland in the face of development. That's when Intersection returns. Welcome back to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. Second only to Alaska, Florida has the most wetlands of any state. But despite federal regulation to protect those wetlands, the Sunshine State is losing this land due to development. In a book he co-authored with Matthew Waite called Paving Paradise, Florida's Vanishing Wetlands and the Failure of No Net Loss, Tampa Bay Times environmental reporter Craig Pittman wrote that since 1990, more than 84,000 acres of wetlands have been lost in Florida. Craig Pittman joins me on the phone from his offices at the Tampa Bay Times. Why are Florida's wetlands so important?
Wetlands provide a variety of natural benefits to us at no cost to us. They offer us flood protection. They act as natural sponges to soak up floodwaters and then release them very slowly during times when we're not having rain, when we're having drought. They filter pollution out of the water. In fact, a lot of times the approach to trying to deal with a pollution problem is to build an artificial wetlands to filter the water flowing through it. Right. And, of course, they provide habitat for a lot of very commercially important species, such as ducks, shrimp, that kind of thing. So they're you know, sort of a natural marvel. If it weren't for them, our aquifer would not be filled up the way it needs to be for us to have drinking supplies as well.
And Florida's wetlands are still pretty vast, right?
Yes, we have the second most wetlands in the nation. The only state that has more is Alaska, and of course, a lot of theirs are, you know, not in the liquid form.
Right. But I think I read 86,000 acres lost since 1990. That's a pretty big acreage.
That was what we found. Yeah, during this period when there's supposed to be no net loss of wetlands, because that's the national policy, we lost 86,000, and that was just to urban uses, to, you know, anything involving pavement, houses, roads, stores, that kind of thing. If you throw in mining and agriculture, that boosts it up to about 100,000 during that time.
So what exactly is no net loss? How is it supposed to work?
Well, the idea is that it's a balancing act that in 1990, then President George H.W. Bush announced that there was going to be this new policy that the nation had lost too many of its precious wetlands, and so the new policy would be no net loss. If you wiped out a wetland to develop something, then you needed to build a new wetland or somehow otherwise make up for that loss so that there would be no net loss and everything would balance out. And numerous scientific studies since then have found that no net loss is just a failure, that efforts to build artificial wetlands don't provide the same benefits that a natural wetland does, that other efforts to make up for the wetland loss have failed, and as a result, the nation is continuing to lose thousands of acres of wetlands, particularly here in Florida, where the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers issues more permits for wetlands destruction than anywhere else in the country.
So what's the answer to all of this from what you've seen and what you're reporting on? The things that are supposed to mitigate some of the effects of development don't work. So what's the answer?
Well, if we could go back to the original plan, the folks who came up with the idea of no net loss was this group of people that included, you know, builders, developers, as well as environmental experts and bureaucratic regulators, and they came up with the idea of no net loss, but it was an interim step. They said we're going to strive for no net loss, but then the next step is to try and create new wetlands to make up for the ones we've already lost, and so I guess the idea is if we could go back to that original idea and the original proposal of, you know, no net loss is a good intention, but it's very, very poorly carried out, and perhaps the people in charge should pay more attention to the reports that have come out from the National Academy of Sciences, among others, saying no net loss isn't working, we need a new system. Mm-hmm. At the end of our book, we actually made a proposal, a 12-step proposal for at least making a more honest system, where we were proposing that the landowners who have wetlands on their property should be given a tax break for maintaining that wetland, and then conversely, that the cost of permits to wipe out wetlands should be far higher than it is now. Right now, it's $100 for a permit, no matter how many acres you're wiping out. Mm-hmm. So if you wipe out 10,000 acres, you pay $100. Well, wouldn't it be smarter if, you know, we as a society decide we value wetlands, and therefore the cost of wiping out 10,000 acres of wetlands is going to be $10,000.
Craig Pittman, isn't there something of that philosophy behind the idea of water farming, the kind of idea that you pay a rancher to store some water on their property rather than building berms and barriers and what have you?
Yes, and that was the idea. It's not a wetland, but it's a sort of an artificial pond, I guess you'd say, a natural reservoir. And the idea is that they would be holding water back from Lake Okeechobee, mm-hmm, in order to keep it from getting too full because they're worried about the dike around the lake failing. So the idea was to do that. And originally the plan was that this would be a way to assist, you know, mom-and-pop farming operations in order to keep their doors open, because, you know, farming is it's a hard way to make a living, especially if you're a small concern. The way it has worked out, however, is that the biggest contract for water farming has gone to the biggest agricultural company in the area, a company called Alico. And when the money for the contract ran out from the South Florida Water Management District, using money from the taxpayers in their 16-county area, then Alico went and lobbied the Florida legislature to use tax money from all of the taxpayers in Florida to continue that contract, and that way they could make, you know, millions of dollars on this. And in the meantime, in order to secure the contract, they're, you know, lobbying all these legislators and also making pretty hefty campaign contributions to them, and even taking some of them on helicopter rides down around the lake, mm-hmm, which only one of them we found declared as a gift. The others said, no, it was an educational thing.
Let me ask you, too, about the idea of these different water management districts. So there are five throughout the state of Florida. Is it helpful having the state split up into those five separate management districts, or do you really need to look at the state as a contiguous whole that should be managed by one district?
Well, the idea behind it is that each one has its own drainage region, and that each one of those 16 county regions have their own particular concerns, and that the people in that area should be the ones deciding the fate of what happens to the water in their area, that those folks would have the interest in saving their own aquifer and preserving their own rivers and wetlands and waterways, and so therefore they should be the ones serving on their water district boards. But over it all is the State Department of Environmental Protection. The DEP secretary is supposed to be in charge of making sure those five water districts are, you know, sort of all on the same page and not, you know, going off in five different directions on issues of importance to the state as a whole. So the system was set up to sort of provide the best of both worlds, to local control but also state oversight. Recently there have been a lot of complaints that the state is coming in and meddling more and more with the local governing board, that, you know, ordering people fired, ordering layoffs. The legislature slashed their ability to levy taxes in order to pay for some of the things they were paying for. Particularly hard hit was the South Florida Water Management District, which had to lay off quite a few of its Everglades scientists, some of the more experienced folks, and more recently was under a lot of political pressure. They cut their tax rate again, even though some environmental groups were saying they feared that that would imperil the continuance of the Everglades restoration program.
There's a massive population growth in Florida. It's one of the fastest growing.
We're now the third most populous state in the country. We passed New York around December, I think.
Right, and you know, one of the things that you see is development. You see subdivisions going up. You see shopping malls to service those subdivisions, schools, houses, what have you. How do you balance the kind of growing population and the needs of the environment? Like, is there a middle path?
Well, I mean, that's the question people have to ask themselves: is what am I willing to give up? What am I interested in saving? You saw a very interesting phenomenon during the last election, where we reelected a governor who is so opposed to growth management that he, worked to abolish the state growth management agency. But on the other hand, 75% of the voters approved Amendment 1, which sets aside money that's supposed to go for acquiring environmentally sensitive land. So I think people are very torn about what they want and what they're interested in and about what the future of Florida is going to be. You tend to see more reaction to things happening on a local level than you do on a state level, that a lot of folks will notice things going on in their own neighborhood. They'll say, wow, somebody built a house next door to me, and now I'm getting all the runoff from that house. What's the deal? Not realizing that, hey, maybe when their house was built, they caused runoff onto the people next door to them. Mm-hmm. But they don't necessarily take the broader view also of, you know, maybe this entire subdivision was built in what used to be wetlands. Maybe the fill dirt that was put in here to fill in the wetland wasn't enough. Maybe it's all, you know, sinking in a low-lying area, and maybe with all the rain we're having, that's why it's suddenly turned into, you know, the canals of Venice instead of being high and dry the way it was when I bought the house. Mm-hmm. So I think there's sort of a perpetual Florida conversation that we all have of, on the one hand, our state's entire economy is built on growth. It's built on this sort
right.
of, you know, Ponzi scheme of, we need to keep bringing in more people or else the whole machine grinds to a halt and everybody's in trouble. And on the other hand, the thing that brings people in is how special our state is, how beautiful it is, the beaches, the forests. Our state parks are a huge attractor. Millions of people visit them every year. They've won national awards. You know, but on the other hand, they're under pressure now to produce more revenue, so now there's talk of, hey, maybe we'll let people graze cattle in there, maybe we'll let people harvest the timber, maybe we'll let hunters go in and hunt in the state parks. So, you know, does that spoil the thing that we established to make things special, or is that a balance that we can live with? And that's sort of the conversation that people need to have as they think about what sort of Florida they want to continue living in.
Craig Pittman covers the environment for the Tampa Bay Times. He is the co-author of Paving Paradise, Florida's Vanishing Wetlands and the Failure of No Net Loss. Craig, thank you very much for speaking to me.
You're welcome.
It'd be Florida's largest land development ever. 16 urban centers, 100 neighborhoods, new expressways and railways, a higher education campus, and all of it built on what is now Central Florida ranch land. The proposed Deseret Ranch development is a collaboration of Osceola County and Florida's largest landowner, the Mormon Church. Don White is the Vice President of Planning at Deseret Cattle and Citrus. He told 90.7 News the plan puts the ranch in a stronger position to respond to growth in the state.
When COCO decided that they were running out of water and they needed water, they reached out to the North Ranch and condemned sufficient drinking water to meet their needs and added a water treatment plant that's located on property that at one time was owned by the ranch. And now the ranch provides the drinking water for the Space Coast. In the case of Brevard County, they were running out of their landfill, was rapidly filling, and they decided they needed to acquire land for a landfill. So where did they look? To the west, of course, across the St. John River, still in Brevard County, but they actually condemned land on the ranch to put in a landfill.
90.7's Amy Green is following the story. She joins me in the studio now. Thanks, Amy.
Happy to be here.
So what are Osceola County and the Mormon Church planning?
Basically a master plan on a scale never achieved before in Florida. The plan is for a metropolis nearly twice the size of Orlando in Osceola County, built on land now used for cattle ranching, citrus production, and hunting. It does set aside land for ranching, farming, and conservation. One protected area would be larger than the Disney Wilderness Preserve. The development wouldn't happen right away. It would unfold over many decades with other growth plans in Osceola County. The proposal extends through 2080. So obviously, by the time the development is built, many of those making the decisions today would no longer be alive.
But Amy, the Mormon Church has raised cattle at Deseret Ranch for more than half a century. The ranch is among the nation's biggest cattle producers, if not the biggest. So why do they want to develop this land now?
You're right. The Mormon Church is the state's largest landowner. Its land holdings in central Florida alone are vast, stretching into Orange, Osceola, and Brevard counties. With Deseret Ranches, it wants to plan now for a more crowded central Florida, decades into the future. So by considering the future now, Osceola County can avoid making mistakes made at the beginning of central Florida's boom 50 years ago. It says piecemeal development in the region has failed to protect natural resources and created a dependency on the automobile. The church anticipates an additional 6 million people in central Florida by 2080, with growth shifting to southeast Orlando, near Orlando International Airport and Medical City. It projects Osceola County's population will jump to 865,000 by 2060. The goal, they say, is to preserve natural resources and promote alternative transportation.
What kind of feedback is this proposal getting?
A state review was supportive, but it did raise some concerns. The St. John's River Water Management District is apprehensive about whether the region's water supply can support a development on such a scale. Charles Pattison of 1,000 Friends of Florida puts it this way.
Where the drinking water is going to come from for, you know, this many people? I mean, this project alone is projected at build-out to have more than 470,000 people, and that's on top of, you know, any other growth that happens in your region.
The Water District also questions plans for a reservoir it says could harm the St. John's River, Pennywash Creek, and Wolf Creek. It says the plan should protect more wetlands. The Department of Transportation is worried about low population densities and sprawl. The department is recommending more compact urban centers to avoid sprawl. Environmentalists are watching closely. Charles Lee of Audubon of Florida describes the proposed development as a risk and an opportunity.
The opportunity is that you have the chance to plan for the future of 133,000 acres of land, and in the process set aside a lot of conservation lands in a contiguous action that you wouldn't ordinarily have the chance to do.
So, Amy, what's next for the proposed Deseret Ranch's development?
Now that the state has finished its review, Osceola County and Deseret Ranches must consider how to modify the plan according to the state's requirements. Deseret Ranch's general manager, Eric Jacobson, says the two will work to address each concern.
Well, I've been speaking to 90.7's Amy Green. Thanks for joining me.
Anytime. Thanks.
Coming up after the break, using oysters to help clean up the Indian River Lagoon. A conversation about that effort and the state of the 153-mile-long waterway. That's after the break. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. The Indian River Lagoon stretches some 153 miles from Volusia County to Palm Beach County. The lagoon's facing some environmental challenges, including an algal bloom that killed some marine animals and plants. But one University of Central Florida professor hopes to clean it up using oysters. Linda Walters is a professor of biology at the University of Central Florida. She specializes in human impacts on the marine environment and joins me in the studio. Welcome to Intersection, Linda.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Well, first of all, what's going on the Brevard coastline? What kind of impacts are there, and what are some of the things that are harming that coastline?
In Brevard County, they have recently started a huge program with funding from the state of Florida to look at how well the Indian River Lagoon is doing or not doing. And one of the main factors they're looking to try to improve is the number of oysters in the estuary. What scientists have documented for a number of years now is that oysters are one of the primary water quality filters that we have. An oyster has been documented to filter 50 gallons of water per day per oyster. So areas where there are algal blooms or high levels of nutrients, oysters are a natural filter for that. So working with our lab, with Brevard County Natural Resources and Brevard Zoo, there is an oyster gardening program that's been going on for over a year now, where throughout the county they have gotten individuals who were willing to grow oysters from babies called spat, oyster spat, and grow them off their dock. And then those oysters have been taken and put into pilot reefs in different parts of Brevard County after they've grown to adult oyster size. And then we've been monitoring how well they've been doing in these different places.
What's a pilot reef?
A pilot reef is just a practice trial reef. So you don't want to go out and do any sort of shoreline restoration until you've actually figured out what's going to work.
Right.
And you're spending a lot of time and a lot of muscle power and a lot of taxpayer dollars to improve the lagoon. But everywhere is different, especially in terms of restoration. So we've done three sites that we've been monitoring for 6 months now, and one of them is spectacular, one of them is pretty good, and one of them ended up being terrible.
So we'll talk a little bit more about the details of how you go in and put those oysters in, but just to back up a bit, we're talking about the Indian River Lagoon. It's a really long stretch of water, 153 miles. It runs alongside the Atlantic coastline from Volusia all the way south to Palm Beach County, and it's facing some big kind of problems there with pollution. So tell me about those three sites. Where's the site where you're doing the best with this trial of oyster reef?
Our best trial site is in the southern part of Brevard County in an area called Scout Island, which is the state park. And there we found that any oysters that are put out there are doing really well. They're growing and they're reproductive size now. There's also natural recruitment. So Volusia County's big issue is that there aren't a lot of oysters naturally. Mm-hmm. There's some pocket areas where we have some, but unlike from the Georgia border down to Volusia County, there aren't a lot of natural reef areas. So you're actually, when you're doing restoration there, you're kind of starting from scratch. That's why we have these pilot reefs.
Mm-hmm.
So the southern part of Brevard County, oysters do well if you put them in as adults to areas, and there's also natural recruitment, oysters coming in naturally. If you go to the middle part of Brevard County, the water quality and other issues weren't really good for either survival or new recruitment. And in the north part at Nickel Park in Brevard County, what we found was that the oysters that we put out did well, but there was no natural recruitment. So we had three different sites that we just picked based on location and ease of access and the depth of the water there and salinity. And they've come out with three very different answers.
That's interesting. So is the water, I mean, it's a very long kind of stretch of water, and I'm guessing the water quality isn't the same entirely?
The water quality is not the same. And I mean, it varies from day to day because the water is moving. But right now there are harmful algal blooms going on from the central IRL to the south IRL. Northern Indian River Lagoon has pretty high water quality right now. You can still see through the water just fine.
So Professor Walters, the algal bloom, though, that happens every year, does it not?
That's an interesting question. I mean, algal blooms have happened for thousands and thousands of years, especially in the summer when the water gets warm and the salinity goes up. But as the years have gone on, more and more recently, we've had more and more algal blooms and different algal blooms. Mm-hmm. So one of my students right now is studying brown tide, which came into the Indian River Lagoon in 2012 and 2013. It had never been seen in the Indian River Lagoon before that, and it had only been documented in Texas prior to that.
Right.
So it most likely existed in a lot of places, but just wasn't documented, since there are very few people who can identify microalgae.
Right.
But it came in, and the water turned into a chocolatey reddish-brown color, and you couldn't see, you know, your hand if you put your hand under the water.
Sounds nasty.
It was. It was actually quite disgusting. There was a large number of die-offs as a result. The clams all died off. There are thoughts that a lot of fish and birds and dolphins were mortalities were associated with it.
Right. So it sort of goes all the way up through the food chain, up to those big mammals like dolphins, manatees.
Yeah. So at the same time, though, the waters were saltier than the ocean because we were having a very hot, dry summer and we'd had very little rain in the spring. Mm-hmm. So you kind of combine the two factors and it's hard to tease them apart. But we have been looking at brown tide and oysters, and what we found is that they will reduce the brown tide reduces the number of oyster larvae that can settle out and attach and grow as oysters. It reduces their growth rate, but it didn't kill them.
Right.
So oysters are one of the, you know, the mighty power guys of the lagoon. They can handle a lot of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
This summer, though, what we found is that for whatever reason, we had a two-week-long low water event where the oysters were out of the water for 2 weeks, and they can't handle that.
Is that connected to what's going on with freshwater in Florida, too?
It'll be partly freshwater inundation, but a lot of it's just how the water is moving in and out of the inlets.
Right.
And where a lot of the oysters are, at least in the northern Indian River Lagoon, the inlet's pretty far away. It's a number of miles away. So the water comes in and gets stuck in, or once it goes out, it stays out. But
so with these trial oyster beds, are you kind of, you know, retrofitting the lagoon to something it was, a way it was before, or are you putting in something brand new to that ecosystem?
That's a really good question. All of our previous oyster restoration in Volusia County has been on historic footprints. What we're doing in Brevard County is areas that did not previously have oysters. Mm-hmm. And so it's a different beast, and it's somewhat controversial because you're putting them on sediment that wasn't oysters before, and you could argue that there are other organisms that were living in that sediment, that you're replacing one species with another. But when the alternative is turning it into some sort of human-made water filtration system, would you rather have that, or would you rather put some oysters in?
Right. So the expense is going to be greater, I imagine, with some human filtration system.
Yeah. If you have to add some more septic control or nutrient filtration devices, it's going to be exorbitant.
Does some of that have to happen anyway, though? I mean, does there need to be is there an impact from, you know, septic tank runoff, other kinds of stuff?
There are a lot of new ordinances in place that are reducing the nutrient loads. And the nutrients are what are going to bring in the harmful algal blooms. There are ordinances as of last year in both Brevard and Volusia County that you cannot use fertilizer with nitrogen and phosphorus from June 1st to September 30th.
Mm-hmm.
And the jury's still out, I think, on how much of an impact it's going to have. But they started a similar program in Tampa Bay about 5 years ago, and they've reduced their nutrient loads by orders of magnitude.
Mm-hmm.
So something as simple as people not putting, you know, hardcore fertilizer on during the summer will have a big impact, more so than septic. They've gotten rid of most of the septic lines that bordered the lagoon.
Mm-hmm. So the fact that this is such a long lagoon, the water quality is different. It varies day to day. You're dealing with, you know, a really long stretch of coastline. Is it difficult to coordinate conservation across those multiple counties?
That's also a good question. There are forming and have formed many different task forces to try to get together to, you know, collaborate both on funding and management plans and, you know, scientific ideas on how to deal with pretty much every organism that's in the lagoon at this point, be it seagrass, be it mangroves and shorelines, be it oysters, be it fish. There's still more to do, but everybody's hearts and goals are in the right place, I think.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with Linda Walters. She's a professor of biology at the University of Central Florida, specializing in human impacts in the marine environment. Linda Walters, what about shoreline erosion? Is that part of it as well, part of the big picture?
One of the big issues that is happening throughout the lagoon and throughout the entire world is shorelines are being eroded. There's an increase in the number of storms that are hitting shorelines. In Mosquito Lagoon, there is a huge boat wake problem. Mm-hmm. So because the lagoon has a very small tide range and it's very shallow, it's only about up to your knee in depth, when you put a big boat in with a large motor, you can make a very large wake signature that erodes either the plants along the shoreline or erodes the oysters from they're also growing along the shoreline. And what we found with oysters is if you're in an area away from boating channels, the oysters will be buried down 4 or 5 inches into the sediment. Once you're near a boating channel, it's about 1 inch.
Mm-hmm.
And once you get to about 1/2 inch, those oysters start kind of tipping around, and the next boat wake can dislodge them and roll them out of the reef altogether.
So essentially, the oysters like fairly settled, calm conditions?
Well, if you think about it, that's what oysters are adapted to. They aren't adapted to protecting themselves from erosion. It's just, oysters have been around for millions of years. It wasn't part of their historic makeup.
Mm-hmm.
And the same with plants. Mangroves in particular have wonderful roots that only go down to a certain depth. So if it's not a lot of wake energy, which would be storms, they can handle that just fine. But once you start having boats going past 50, 60, 70 per hour, each one eroding a little bit more sediment, all of a sudden those roots become exposed.
Just getting back to how you actually put these test beds in, how do you do it?
What we're using is very simply putting live oysters or oyster shell into mesh bags and putting them out at the right depth, at the right locations and replicated, and then going back with an army of students and removing all the shells from the bags and counting them, getting lengths on the oysters that are alive and survival numbers and growth and new recruitment.
Mm-hmm.
So we did that at the beginning of July. That was pretty hard 2 weeks taking care of those.
So given the fact that you've had some pretty good success in at least one of the sites there, are you going to develop more sites?
Well, that's up to Brevard County Natural Resources, but yes. Once they can figure out sites that are similar to the good test site, then we're in business for larger scale restoration.
Mm-hmm. So Linda Walters, you've spent a fair bit of time paddling around in the lagoon, seeing what the water quality is like. What's your sense of how this project is going to unfold, and if you need to do more things down the line? Are you confident about improving the health of that lagoon?
I am always confident about the In River Lagoon. It's going to be around a lot longer than we are, and it's resilient.
Mm-hmm.
So it's been struggling recently, but I think there are enough good people who care about it that the right measures are going to be taken, and it's just going to become part of everybody's lifestyle to take care of the lagoon, and it will do fine.
And what's next for the summer as far as you're concerned?
We have been in the field since the end of May, looking at oysters from the Georgia border all the way down to southern Brevard County. So we're actually, and my students are very sad about this, we are now at the point where we're entering data,
mm-hmm.
which means being in the lab instead of being in the field. But most of them are pretty sunburned and pretty tired at this point, so it's a good transition.
Linda Walters is a professor of biology at the University of Central Florida. We've been talking about the impact of humans and other things in the marine environment, specifically the Indian River Lagoon. Linda, thank you so much for coming in and speaking to me.
My pleasure.
Support for Intersection comes from Florida Hospital and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. The executive producer is Catherine Welch. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.